Welcome to Saving the Game. This is episode 1, recorded Wednesday, June 20th. Today's topic is, Are RPGs Evil? With your hosts, Grant and Peter.
Welcome to Saving the Game. I'm Grant.
And I'm Peter.
And this is our very first episode, or at least our first real episode.
Yeah, something to celebrate for sure. Bear with us. We are new to this podcasting thing, but we're hoping to give you something interesting and hopefully at least a little bit edifying to listen to as well.
Absolutely. I'm here. I got my mic. I have some soup.
I got a cup of tea here. We're good to go.
There you go. Yeah, we've actually got some friends over tonight, and they brought over some soup that they had made. So I'm looking forward to this.
Awesome. Homemade soup is always good stuff.
It always is. It's delicious.
Do your friends go to the trouble of making their own stock, or...?
It's a pretty watery soup, so I don't know. Also, I don't know how to make stock. For that matter, I'm not entirely sure I know how to make soup, so...
Well, you make stock by throwing a bunch of bones in some water with a little bit of meat on them and boiling the living daylights out of it until you get a lot of gelatin in the soup and you get some really nice... My wife is a little bit of a cooking geek,
gotcha. So
I pick some of this up by osmosis.
Gotcha. There is not a lot of gelatinous soupiness to it, so I am going to guess no. It's mostly vegetables anyway, I think.
Oh, okay.
So.
Well, that's good for summertime when we're recording this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's been a hot day here, so...
Oh, same here. I think we're near record temperatures.
Yeah.
Just for the listeners that don't know, I'm in Illinois, and Grant, you are in North Carolina?
South Carolina. The upstate of South Carolina. So, you know, we're at least, well, we don't have the coast to help us out, but I am in the mountains, or at least kind of up towards it. So we get a little bit of help from elevation. Worst part of the state, far and away, is the middle. It's flat, but it's just heat and sand and kind of dusty.
Yeah, I'm out here baking on the Great Plains. I'm very grateful to the person who invented air conditioning right about now, because there's one about 10 feet from me just running on maximum.
Excellent. Good for it.
As it's been doing all day.
Yep. Yep. Unfortunately, we have a little bit of shade on our house, and that helps out. So.
Always a good thing.
Yep. Plus, when we rebuilt the house, we actually put insulation in the walls, which it didn't have before.
How old is your house?
It's about 60 years old. My wife's grandfather built it by himself, which is an impressive feat right there.
Yeah, no kidding. Man didn't believe in insulation, though, huh?
Well, it's more that a lot of these old houses just don't have the same sort of insulation. There's loose vermiculite insulation in the ceiling in some places, most of it really, at this point. But the walls, completely uninsulated.
It's a good thing you don't get the kind of winters there that we get here in the Midwest.
Absolutely, but we do, of course, get very hot summers.
Yeah.
And it's our energy bill has dropped enormously since we paid for insulation to get sprayed into the walls.
Oh, I can imagine.
Yeah, it's helped a ton. And we have more efficient windows. We put all new windows in the house when we rebuilt it last year, so it's a lot more efficient. And I'm very comfortable. It's awesome.
Good deal.
Yep.
So, for our first topic tonight, we figured we'd get kind of the big sword of Damocles that would be hanging over us if we didn't address it cut down. And we're going to go ahead and address the critique of role-playing games as inherently evil that you sometimes hear.
Yes, and this is mostly from people who haven't had anything to do with the hobby, or people who have only heard about the hobby from various sources in equally misinformed media, and unfortunately, a few people who just sort of want to make a name for themselves. There have been a few cases of that, though we're not really going to talk about those too much.
No, I would rather not give any additional notoriety to people who are just seeking that at the expense of a perfectly legitimate hobby.
Absolutely. And there's a piece of scripture that's relevant to this, I think. And this is something I hope that we do each episode, if not scripture, at least something from writings within the Christian tradition. But this particular short line of scripture is Romans 14:16. Therefore, do not let what you know is good be spoken of as evil. I know for a fact, from personal experience, from experience with other people who I've met in my life, and people who I've met on various forums, which more and more through things like Skype and Facebook are just as, you know, the relationships there are just as real as face-to-face, real life, quote-unquote, friendships.
Oh, yeah. My wife and I are an internet couple. I don't know if you knew that.
No, I didn't. Just met through a forum?
No, actually, a chat room. I was looking for a political debate before the 2000 election. I knew my wife's politics before I knew she was female.
Nice. There you go. So, hang on. It's a relationship that started and stayed because of politics. I'm terribly confused. I think you violated every rule of the internet right there.
We moved on from politics pretty quickly.
Smart man. But yeah, this particular line, therefore do not let you what you know is good be spoken of as evil, I think really sort of reflects our responsibility if we're going to, in any way, shape, or form, claim the mantle of Christian RPG podcast. Because we both know that role-playing games are good, or can be good.
Yeah. I would say they're probably neutral in the same way that video is neutral, that print media like books and magazines are neutral, and that music is neutral.
Right.
You can send a message that is incredibly edifying or downright disturbing with any of those mediums.
Very true. They're a method of communication, they're a method of entertainment, they're, like a friend of mine just said a few minutes ago, In the geekiest possible analogy, it's much like Yoda's cave and Empire Strikes Back. What's in the cave is exactly what you bring to it.
Yep.
Role-playing games really sort of work the same way. There's nothing inherently good or evil about them, though I think there are many more aspects that work towards good than bad. You know, they're not inherently evil or good, but the people who play them are. And those get reflected and refined through role-playing games.
Just like any other creative expression, the contents within are going to reflect the creators.
Absolutely. And we're going to, I'm sure, have the same discussion about video games at some point, too.
I would imagine so, yes.
And probably books and a few other things. But if we're claiming that Christian RPG mantle, this is the elephant in the room. I know neither of us wanted to talk about it first, but let's go ahead and do it.
Yeah, I think we both agreed that we had to. So we've got a kind of a list of common misconceptions that we came up with when we were tossing this around between us in our pre-show. And I think probably the first one that we should address is the concept that role-playing games means only fantasy.
Yes.
Now, I'd like to get into some of the root influences of modern fantasy, but let's put this one to rest right away. There's role-playing games in just about any setting that you can think of. In fact, the first one that I ever read anything for, wrote anything for, or played myself is one called GURPS that's put out by Steve Jackson Games. GURPS is actually an acronym. It stands for Generic Universal Role-Playing System. It is a toolbox. You can do anything from hard science fiction, which is usually near-future science fiction that's designed to be as plausible as possible, the kind of 5 minutes into the future sort of thing that you'll see in a lot of television thrillers with light sci-fi elements, all the way over to crazy superhero stuff or the most extreme fantasy you can imagine with flying cities and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that's just one system. There's more of those out there. There's Hero System, Savage Worlds that you've got some experience with, Grant.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also setting-specific systems that cover things other than fantasy. Traveler comes to mind. There's a member of some forums that were on all the time where there's a guy who runs Traveler enough that he's actually gotten somewhat infamous for it.
Hey, Church.
Yeah, yeah. Can you think of anything else?
Well, I mean, what's interesting about role-playing games is they really cover the entire spectrum of written media. There are role-playing games for science fiction. There are role-playing games for fantasy. But there are role-playing games set in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s pulp era. Spirit of the Century comes to mind there. It's those pulp paperback novels and pulpy comics that people used to read, that some people still read, that so many delightfully fun, terabad movies were based on. There's a role-playing game for those.
In fact, it's called Spirit of the Century.
Yes, and it's fantastic, by the way.
Yes, it is.
There's role-playing games set in the 15th century, during the exploration of the New World. There's role-playing games set during the Crusades.
There's one set during modern times. I played a private security contractor for a while in a game on some forums that we both frequent.
There are games set in everything. There are a few Christian RPGs. Unfortunately, none of them are terribly good, which
kind of warrants its own podcast.
Yeah, that's going to be an episode at some point. It's on our list, but there are a few out there. The one very close to Christianity, reflecting Mormonism, that is actually very good is Dogs in the Vineyard, and it's got earned itself a lot of acclaim. It's very good, and it's set in the late 1800s in what is essentially Utah. They kind of filed the serial numbers off Mormonism in Utah in this case, but it's very much...
Yeah, they didn't file the serial numbers off very thoroughly. You can kind of make out a digit here and there.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious, but it's a very good game.
I've never gotten a chance to actually play it. Have you, Grant?
I have not. It's definitely high up on my list.
Yeah, I read the book and wanted to immediately, but I never got the chance.
Yeah, it's excellent. There are games set, you know, modern day. You know, they're based on, essentially, Ghostbusters. I'm thinking specifically of Inspectors, though of course there's an official Ghostbusters RPG, you know, and they're just normal everyday things with, oh hey, there's ghosts and other things that go bump in the night. In fact, there's a huge category of horror games, things that go bump in the night and do horrible, horrible things. Call of Cthulhu is the most famous, of course, but there's any number of other horror games. Don't Rest Your Head.
Are we gonna call Don't Rest Your Head horror? It seems more like modern urban fantasy kind of. We may have to address that specific one at some point in time, maybe even later this episode.
I think so. Don't Rest Your Head is a very good, it's an interesting psychological game. Dread is, of course, one that's gotten very popular kind of in the indie circuit lately. Maybe the most famous or best-known horror game out there is the D&D supplements and series Castle Ravenloft.
Yeah.
There are games that are... just, they really cover the gamut of all fiction out there. There are games that are based in that have absolutely no fantastical elements of any sort, no fantasy, no sci-fi, no nothing, and they're fun. They're all about just relationships between people. Fiasco comes to mind. Doesn't have to have any fantastic elements at all. It's just people doing crazy things and things going badly for everybody. It's a Coen Brothers movie simulator, is how I've heard Fiasco described.
So basically, this should give you kind of a sense that role-playing games are as broad and as diverse as any other sort of media that you would want to consume.
Absolutely.
The concept that this is something that is only fantasy or only one specific sort of fantasy should be completely gone.
That's
just
true.
From listening to the last few minutes of us talking here.
Now, there's one system that we've only barely mentioned in passing, and that's Dungeons & Dragons.
Yes.
Dungeons & Dragons is why people tend to think that role-playing games only mean fantasy, because it is the most popular system out there, and it's the best known, and it's the oldest popular role-playing game. There were a few predecessors to it, but that's the granddaddy of all the systems.
So let's get into the roots of the fantasy that are portrayed in Dungeons & Dragons a little bit, because I think some of our listeners may find this interesting.
Yes, please.
Two of the kind of fathers of modern fantasy, with traveling between worlds, orcs, elves, dwarves, goblins, that sort of thing, are J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of Lord of the Rings, and his close friend and contemporary, C.S. Lewis, who wrote the Chronicles of Narnia, but who also wrote things like Mere Christianity, Miracles, The Great Divorce, The Screwtape Letters. Some people have actually referred to C.S. Lewis as the prophet of the 20th century.
He's certainly an amazing lay theologian.
Yeah. Probably one of the best who ever lived, I would go so far as to say. Tolkien, the author of Lord of the Rings, was a devout Catholic. They were very close friends with each other, and you will see their fingerprints all over D&D. Particularly Tolkien's. A lot of the creatures and the types of fantastic elements that exist, especially in earlier editions of D&D, are Tolkien without the serial numbers even filed off, to the point where there were actually some copyright infringement suits in there. Now, there are also very definitely some non-Christian influences in D&D. H.P. Lovecraft supplied some creatures and some general feel for some of... yeah.
Thematic elements, absolutely.
Michael Moorcock and Robert E. Howard also spring to mind. Michael Moorcock was the writer of the Elric of Melnibone novels, which are kind of a... I haven't read them myself, but from what I understand, they're kind of a dark fantasy that precedes Tolkien by a few years.
You know, I'm not sure
Am I getting that right, or did he come afterwards?
Moorcock's work was, as I understand it, a counterpoint to Robert Howard's work. Howard was Sword and Sorcery and Sandals, the classic shirtless Conan the Barbarian, the author of...
Yeah, he created Conan, Kull, and Solomon Kane are probably the three characters of his that you'd be most familiar with.
Moorcock basically wanted to write something that sort of countered that in all of Howard's work and all of work that was inspired by it. Magic was this evil, cowardly sort of thing, and the dark anti-hero of Moorcock's work was a wizard. He used magic as opposed to raw physical strength.
Which Howard's characters are known for having in spades.
Absolutely.
I think probably his most subtle character is Solomon Kane, and even he's kind of a lethal swordsman comes to mind.
Yes, a swashbuckling adventurer in many ways.
Yeah.
We've mentioned five authors. There are, of course, plenty of others.
Yeah, Jack Vance, for instance.
Jack Vance, Lord Dunsany, plenty of others who've influenced D&D, not just from its inception, its first publication in 1974, but really throughout its history. And the fantasy genre as a whole has certainly evolved since then.
And that's one thing that that kind of muddies the waters a little bit with discussing things with D&D is it's neither a static thing nor something that just draws from one well. With every edition that comes out, and they're coming out with, what, 5th edition later this year?
They aren't, well, they haven't set an exact time frame, but the playtest of D&D Next, as they're calling it, the 5th edition of D&D, has already come out, and they're gathering feedback on that. I'm guessing it's coming out this year, probably Christmas time. They might wait till 2013 if they have problems.
I know when they released 3rd edition, that was during the summer, and I think 4th was too, but...
Yes, it was.
So it might be next summer that they're shooting for.
Could be.
Get everybody on summer vacation, get all those campaigns started while nobody's in school.
Yeah, that's a good point. Hopefully by now we've illustrated that role-playing games are not only fantasy. The big name? Yes, it's fantasy. Dungeons & Dragons. Although even that is in some ways technically not true. There are D&D systems. The D&D system has been expanded enormously and doesn't even encompass fantasy by only anymore.
Especially since the advent of the Open Gaming License, D20 has basically turned into the world's largest universal system.
Now that fantasy thing, though, really brings us to the next topic, which is that because there's fantasy, and because there's magic, and because supernatural evil entities are mentioned in the game, demons, devils,
etc. Yeah, let's not beat around this bush. I mean, monstrous demons, tempter devils, rampaging dragons, there's some pretty scary, awful stuff in there.
Because those things are in the game, therefore that must mean that playing the game means that you're dealing with these in some form, whether you're actively participating in evil acts. There's a rather infamous Jack Chick tract that claims that that's
the
case.
Infamous Dark Dungeons.
Dark Dungeons, oh yes. And even if that's not the concern, it's the idea that, well, you're playing these things and these are in there and you shouldn't be exposed to them. That's a bad thing. The interesting thing about D&D is that especially in that first edition that everybody was concerned about, all of these things were always and without exception presented as the enemies of humanity, the enemies of all that is good. They were not presented as things for your characters to interact with.
At least not in any way other than at sword point.
Yeah, they were there to be defeated, killed, driven out, cleansed from the earth, and your heroic characters were there to protect other people.
Defend and preserve against the depredations of these things.
Absolutely. What's interesting is that in many ways when they released second edition and took out so much of this from the core rulebook and sort of watered everything down after all the criticism that D&D got, in many ways the second edition of D&D became less effective as a tool for Christians to use and as almost a practice space for Christians.
I think, especially once you started getting into some of the later editions, it started getting a little more modular with the ways that you could use these elements in the rules. They started using kind of the same sort of stat blocks that you use for player characters and that sort of thing, and they became a little less alien and a little less horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they were still very much held up as something to be defeated, destroyed, opposed, and, you know, otherwise acted against. But I think maybe, and it's important to remember while we're discussing this, that as much of a bad rap as he got, Gary Gygax, one of the two creators of Dungeons & Dragons, was a fairly devout Christian himself, and was actually involved in some charitable work with various Christian organizations. He actually kind of kept his faith quiet for a good chunk of his life after some of the controversies surrounding his game, because he felt he was going to give Christianity a bad name by being associated with what he had created, and a short while before he died kind of stopped doing that. Some interesting and kind of sad stories there, but I guess what we're really trying to come around to is, while it's been to greater and lesser extents, things like demons, devils, dragons, and other rapacious evil things are not looked at as something that player characters are supposed to interact with in any sort of civil way, really. The scene that comes to mind from those of you that have seen the Lord of the Rings movies is Gandalf facing down the huge demon and saying, "You shall not pass."
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's kind of a classic D&D moment there, is big horrifying evil, but someone willing to face it down, which is very much a Christian thing, something that we're asked to do.
Yeah.
One of the things we're going to talk about here in a little bit is how role-playing games can be sort of a way to practice and strengthen that reflex to face the, you know, those things down and not turn and run and to stand up for what really is right. The other kind of other side of this whole worry about, oh, well, there's demons in there. Oh, well, there's magic in there. Here's the thing. There's no instructions on how to cast magic spells in D&D or any other role-playing game out there.
At least none that I've ever seen.
No. It's always possible that somebody somewhere has written something that has actually got research in occultism and has some grounding in occultist traditions. I can tell you right now, Dungeons & Dragons is not one of them.
No.
You know how you cast a lightning bolt in D&D? You take a little piece of amber, and you rub it with some cotton wool and make a spark.
Yeah, most of the magic in D&D is much more superpower-ish, especially in the way that a lot of characters and players will handle it in the game.
Yeah.
And
no, there's no acting it out.
No. I can't remember the last time that I sat at a gaming table and actually had somebody pay any attention to any of the supposed components of any of the magic stuff in there, except for if they were trying to figure out whether they could cast something that would help them escape from being chained up by the bad guys.
Yeah. There's rules in there for, well, okay, when a wizard casts a spell, they say something and they make motions with their hands. And that's, by the way, about as descriptive as it gets. There's, occasionally in some of the fluff, as they call it, for the spell, some description, you have to do this. And by this, they mean things like, take a piece of amber, rub it with some cotton wool, or...
The fireball is great. It's like basically a little firework tube that you point with the bat guano and I think some sulfur or something like that.
Yeah.
The idea is that
it's a flick a ball of bat guano at somebody.
Yeah. What you'd get in real life if you did this, by the way, would be either a mess or a smoke bomb, I believe.
Yes. Or possibly a punch to the face for flinging poop at somebody.
Well, yes, you would almost certainly get that.
Yeah.
But you would certainly not be flinging a exploding fireball that could engulf a target the size of... Geez, what's the explosive radius on the fireball spell?
Well, so, like, yeah, 40 feet across.
Yeah, you will not get anything anywhere near a car's gas tank exploding.
You will get a small, sticky, stinky spot on your carpet.
Or the sidewalk, if you're wise enough to try this outdoors.
Yes, not the same. So, no.
No.
There's no real magic in D&D, or really any of these other major games. Like I said, there may be somebody somewhere who wrote their own game where they did some research. I don't know of any. Peter, I don't think you know of any.
There's a book out there called Authentic Thaumaturgy that was written more as a kind of like a study of real-world occult practices for people that are trying to create some more verisimilitude in games, but mm-hmm. it's not an actual game system. It's more like a very long research paper on real-world occult traditions.
Sure, yeah, but that's about as close as I've even heard of. Now, of course, we've talked about magic, and we've talked about demons and devils. The other big complaint about role-playing games, and again, I want to stress that so far we're really mostly just talking about fantasy role-playing games, is that they promote polytheism or alternate beliefs or something that isn't Christianity. There's two parts to this. First, let's be honest, people who write role-playing games are trying to sell a product. They're not going to limit their audience to just Christians. Yes, Christians make up most of the American population and thus the consumer market for products, but these games get translated, they're sold all over the world, and nobody's going to generally want to write a game, especially for a major company, that inherently limits the people it's marketed to. So they make things up, and thus offend nobody.
And the polytheism depicted in most role-playing books, although I have seen, like, ancient Norse, Greek, and Egyptian pantheons depicted, is mostly totally made-up stuff based entirely on trying to come up with something cool.
Yes. It's, this sounds neat. As opposed to anything really related to modern mythology or other religions.
In fact, the designers will normally take kind of a toolbox a la carte kind of approach to things, and it's like, we want deities that represent war, disease, healing, plants, canaries, and back scratching. And they will come up with custom diseases for war, disease, canaries, plants, and back scratching.
Yep.
There's nothing even vaguely resembling real religion in most of these books.
Not at all. And I think this is good. Because if I'm running a game, the last thing I want to do is, if somebody's playing somebody who has a close connection with the divine, like a cleric or a paladin, the last thing I want to do is to decide the will of God in a situation like that and say, no, I think God would do this. That's the last thing I want to do.
Yeah.
I do not. It's a bit presumptuous to ask the GM to stand in for the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac. No, thank you. I'd rather not. Yeah. It's safer for me to say, your entirely fictional deity does entirely fictional things.
In an entirely fictional way, in an entirely fictional place, to your entirely fictional character who is interacting with another entirely fictional character.
Yeah. There's a certain safety net there that we as Christians really should appreciate.
That said, in a non-overtly supernatural game, playing a character with genuine religious faith could certainly be compelling.
Absolutely, and that's something I want to talk about later on in this episode. There is no reason that you can't take these games and make them Christian. It's just that they're not generally written as such because it doesn't sell terribly well. If you're comfortable doing that, especially if you're comfortable playing Christian characters, absolutely.
Yeah.
The beauty of a role-playing game is that they're innately changeable. They are yours to change as you see fit and make them fit into what you need them to be. In fact, I believe in the original D&D books, it was very clearly stated that these rules were a starting point and that you ought to change them to suit your needs. And pretty much every role-playing game I've seen has followed suit. The next thing that I have kind of heard some complaints about is sexual overtones. Mostly related to imagery.
Yeah, let's be honest. This can be a problem in some gaming books.
It can be.
I've seen some pretty scandalous artwork in a few of them.
I have too. That said, I would not call it particularly worse than most other media. It tends to just sort of follow media. And let's be honest, who are we selling the product to? Nerdy guys.
Yeah.
It does exist, and I would certainly understand somebody not wanting to buy a role-playing game book for their young children if it had imagery like this in it.
It's important to note that that kind of artwork or imagery is by no means universal, though.
No, absolutely not.
The artwork in most of the GURPS books that I cut my teeth on as a role player was generally very tasteful. And some points you'd see, like, classical woodcut kind of architecture and more science fiction oriented things. You'd see stuff that almost looked like technical diagrams sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd see plenty of just kind of generic page filler artwork. This is the uniform of this particular military unit, or this is what this particular castle looks like, or that sort of thing.
It's not a hard and fast rule, but many times I will look at a book, and if it does have overtly sexualized artwork, I'll wonder, if they're trying to sell it on this, why aren't they trying to sell it on the contents of the book?
Yeah.
There's often an inverse relationship there.
Yeah, if you're getting a lot of kind of tawdry artwork, chances are the words are not very interesting.
No.
And you can probably just leave that on the shelf.
Yeah, much in the same way that if I see a trailer for a movie and it's mostly skin, the movie's probably not that good if that's the only way they're able to sell it.
Yeah. Just like there are B-movies and trashy paperback books, there are definitely different classes of quality in the RPG industry, for sure.
Some of them are bad.
Oh, yeah.
It happens.
I'm not beating around the bush. Some of them are absolutely flat-out terrible. Bad content-wise, bad mechanics-wise, poorly laid out, poorly produced. Pretty much anything that you can think of to criticize, from content to binding quality, I have seen good and bad of in the gaming sphere.
So, let's not pretend this doesn't exist, but I don't want anybody who's listening to this podcast and who doesn't know anything about role-playing games to think all role-playing games have these highly sexualized images in them. The vast majority do not, and if some of them do, it's A, either a sign that the book just isn't that good and that's how they're trying to sell it, or B, in the cases I have seen, a lot of times that's representing something that's dangerous and something tempting, but which will end up being bad for your characters.
Yeah, the succubus legends that get translated into monster manuals are a perfect example.
Exactly.
Tempting and sultry and will totally tear you in half if you get close.
Yeah, not good.
No.
It's not pornographic by any stretch of the imagination in the vast majority of these books. And if you see one that is, don't buy it.
Yeah, vote with your feet and your dollar, just like any other kind of media.
And if it's not sex that's being critiqued, it's violence.
Role-playing games tend to be very violent things.
They do. And there's several reasons for that, not least that combat is the easiest thing to write rules for in a role-playing game. And it's full of action and excitement, and violence is fun in the same way that action movies are fun.
Generally speaking, your typical role-playing game is an extended adventure tale. You'll wind up with kind of a slow lead-off with a small group of heroes someplace, either who already know each other or who get gathered together very quickly at the beginning of the story arc. And as things progress, they'll go through kind of the mythical hero's journey that you may be familiar with from mythology classes and go on to deal with some sort of threat to themselves, their communities, or their way of life, or possibly even the entire setting that they're in. In fact, the saving the world plot is so common as to be considered a cliche in gaming circles, as I'm sure a lot of you know.
I've actually heard a gamer remark that saving the world over and over has gotten tiresome.
Yes. It would be nice to just save a town, or maybe one person.
Or maybe not save people, but do something else, like open a store.
Yeah.
Or just survive for a little while. That's a classic horror trope right there. But yes, violence absolutely exists in role-playing games. I will tell you right now, I don't think that's a bad thing. There are a lot of traditions of violence as a good thing. If we all innately thought that violence was a terrible thing in all situations, we wouldn't have a military, and we wouldn't say, well, it's a good thing that people are in the military.
You truthfully wouldn't even have civilization.
No.
Without going too far off the range, Lieutenant Colonel, I believe he is his rank, Dave Grossman, the author of On Killing, has referred to there being three types of people. The most common are sheep, which are gentle, productive, and only capable of hurting each other by accident. Then there are the wolves, which are your typical violent criminal. They're capable of violence, and they basically have no conscience. And then there's a third class that he refers to as the sheepdogs, which guard everybody else and do the fighting so that they don't have to. These are your kind of your protector class. These are your soldiers, your police officers, sometimes even your intelligence community or even other emergency workers like firefighters and paramedics. Generally speaking, when you're in a role-playing game, you're depicting the sheepdogs. There's a town behind you or a nation behind you or even just a small family behind you that needs to somehow be protected, preserved, or otherwise kept safe from something very bad that will affect them in a spectacularly negative way if the players don't intervene.
Yeah. And not all games have violence. Let's be clear about that. But a lot of them do, and it's because that violence is used to solve a problem that in many cases can't be solved any other way. Or if it can be solved in some other way, the most obvious way to solve it is violence.
You're certainly not going to talk down your average rampaging monster.
No, certainly not. Or your average evil empire.
Yeah, yeah.
To a certain degree, it's the nature of fiction, and it's the nature of people to enjoy action and adventure. It's inherent in the product, but it's not violence for the sake of violence. It's not violence for the sake of murder and mayhem. It serves a purpose.
This kind of feeds into just war theory a little bit.
Absolutely. The idea that there are times when violence is justified. And in most of the games that I have played, in all honesty, you could get by without firing a shot or swinging a sword. And if you as a Christian think that violence is inherently bad, which I'll admit I think is not too far off the mark, Christ telling Peter to put down his sword and healing the ear of the soldier whose ear was struck off, Romans are taking Christ away, certainly is suggestive of how Christ wants us to live and how our relationship to violence as Christians should be.
Let's not forget that Christ overturned tables and chased people out using his belt as a whip in the temple, though. So
it's very true.
The context is important.
Yeah, context is important. You know, violence is there, and if you want to take it out of your game, I wholeheartedly recommend that you do so. In many ways, the game will be more interesting for it, because you'll have to think instead of going, well, I think I can hit that. But the fact that it's in there does not make a role-playing game of any variety a bad thing. As we said before, these are very malleable games. Anything in there can be changed.
And I will also add that if you're still skeptical after hearing this, a lot of Christian fiction and even parts of the Bible contain some pretty heavy-duty violence.
Very true.
The Book of Judges is loaded with violence. The Chronicles of Narnia have some definite violent bits to them.
Mm-hmm.
Lord of the Rings has some violence to it. If you want to get more modern with things, the works of Frank Peretti, a well-known Christian author, who we might get into a little bit if we start discussing horror, because I don't think all horror is inherently incompatible with Christianity, and I would use his books as one of the exhibits for that, but there's definitely some violence in there, particularly in the spirit world with angels and demons hacking each other up with swords and stuff. So, it's violence isn't the most pleasant topic all the time, but I think if you handle it properly, it can play a part in any good fiction, gaming included.
Indeed. And it's not just modern writing that has this. Milton's Paradise Lost describes a war in heaven. The La Morte d'Arthur, the Arthurian legends, a tale of Christian knights seeking the Holy Grail, is filled with duels and tournaments and all-out warfare. These things are part of the Christian tradition, and it's very rarely a bad thing when somebody raises a sword in Christ's name. Not to say it hasn't been on occasion.
The one thing that I would want to throw in there is Christianity itself went off the rails a little bit during the medieval ages with things like crusades and inquisitions, and I think it's important where if you're portraying godly characters in fiction, that you not fall into kind of the model of anybody who doesn't agree with me needs to die.
Yes.
That is not the attitude that Christ ever advocated, and that really has no place in any kind of authentic portrayal of Christian faith.
So I think we've beat that one over the head a few times.
Yes, yes. We have beaten violence to death.
There are a couple of cases out there that people bring up.
One real quick thing before we get into these cases.
Yeah.
To kind of summarize everything that's back here, even if, after hearing our arguments, you are unconvinced and you think that fantasy role-playing is inherently bad, stay away from fantasy. There's plenty of non-fantastical, non-violent ways that you can use role-playing as a tool, and we'll get into those in some future episodes. But once again, the core elements of role-playing, which is basically collaborative creation of fiction, does not have to include any of the elements that it stereotypically has.
And if you want some other more detailed examples, frankly, we're cribbing a lot of our outline here from the Christian Gamers Guild, a sadly mostly defunct website. that we'll link in the show notes here, christian-gamers-guild.com, where they have a long FAQ talking about all of these things and making some very good arguments.
It's actually .org.
Oh, .org, excuse me. Christian-gamers-guild.org. Thank you. Go check them out. Like I said, the site is mostly defunct, but it's still up. They've got a Yahoo group going still, but that's about it as far as activity on the site. But it's a very interesting and very good resource. And some of the other things that they talk about on there are a lot of these cases that people quote, crimes and suicides and murders and occult rituals and that sort of thing that supposedly are related to role-playing games. Now, I don't want to talk about people who have made up stories about role-playing games and their experience in the occult. There are a few of them, and we're not going to humor them by mentioning them here.
We've already dropped Jack Chick's name. That's as far as we're going with this.
But there's two in particular that I want to mention, because it's interesting in how little some of these attitudes have changed over 30-plus years of gaming. The first one that comes to mind is the Dallas Egbert case. If you have seen the movie Mazes and Monsters or read the book that the movie was based on, the Dallas Egbert case in 1979 was the original inspiration for that. And everything in Mazes and Monsters, kids running around in steam tunnels playing Dungeons and Dragons and committing suicide, pretty much inaccurate. There was a kid named James Dallas Egbert III who played D&D in high school. He went to college at age 16, very bright kid, went to Michigan State University, and was terribly depressed, was under intense parental pressure to succeed, in large part because he was incredibly bright, had no friends there, was coping with isolation and intense pressure, drug addiction, generally just not somebody who was in good shape.
Really kind of a very tragic case.
Absolutely tragic, and surprisingly close to my own experiences in college, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But he attempted to commit suicide by taking a bottle of methaqualone down into the MSU steam tunnels that kind of run underneath the campus, provide heat and hot water to the campus. Drank the bottle down there, failed to die, woke up about a day later, left the tunnels, went to hide with friends. Well, he'd gone missing. His family, in a desperate attempt to find him, hired a private investigator named William Deere, who, after talking with his parents and learning that their son had played D&D in high school, talked with some friends, learned about him talking about these steam tunnels, and kind of out of whole cloth and ignorance, concocted a theory that Dallas Egbert had become lost in these MSU steam tunnels as part of a live-action D&D game.
Leaving any prejudice we have towards or against LARPing out of this for the moment.
Right.
That wasn't what he was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
LARPing is something else we'll have to talk about. As far as anybody knows, Dallas Egbert never played D&D while at MSU. The media covering the search for Egbert presented this hypothesis, which was purely a hypothesis on William Deere's part, and without having read his book or anything, I think a fairly innocent hypothesis. This was, hey, here's a possibility. The media covering the story grabbed that and ran it as fact, which ended up generating a weeks-long search for Dallas Egbert in those steam tunnels.
This is one of those cases where you get kind of sloppy journalism that creates an issue of events, or a version of events,
yeah,
that isn't actually accurate, but it's kind of hard to put the genie back in the bottle.
Absolutely. Dallas Egbert hid with friends for a while, moving from house to house, eventually fled to New Orleans, where he again attempted suicide, this time with cyanide, and then moved to Morgan City, Louisiana, contacted William Deere there. And this is where it kind of gets interesting for me. He kind of told William Deere what had actually happened and said, you know what, I'm okay here, I'm living with an uncle, I've got a job, I don't want to go back to MSU, and I don't want publicity because I'm trying to deal with all of this stuff and it's not working for me. And Deere agreed to conceal the truth of what happened. This ended up being bad for two reasons. First and most importantly, Dallas Egbert, within the next year, successfully committed suicide, this time by shooting himself. And it's possible that had Deere not kept silent, it's possible he would have gotten help. But it's hard to say, and I don't want to second-guess somebody who thought he was doing the best thing he could. But that also means that it was only about 4 years later that William Deere revealed the truth of what happened in a book that he wrote in 1984 called The Dungeon Master. And that meant that there was 4, maybe 5 years of noise and misleading theories and all that sort of stuff. Deere's account of what happened came out after the Mazes and Monsters book came out that had this wild theory and presented it as fact. So I think the delay there generated a lot of misunderstanding of role-playing games, especially because, you know, this was role-playing games being presented in this bad light, you know, driving this brilliant young mind to suicide, that sort of thing.
And really, to break this down a bit, I would say it's probably a safe guess that Egbert liked ice cream, and this would be like associating his suicide with ice cream.
Yeah.
Role-playing games were something that he occasionally enjoyed and had participated in the past, but really didn't have any connection with his death.
Right. And unfortunately, especially since there's this Tom Hanks movie, that's one of the ways people know about role-playing games and Dungeons and Dragons, and it's just not a realistic portrayal of role-playing games and the hobby in general. The funny thing about this case is there's a parallel here to my own college experience. I was at the top of my class in high school, and it was a hard class to be up towards the top of. I was had the sixth highest GPA in an international baccalaureate program with two people out of about 50 who scored 1600s on their SATs. Two of my best friends went to Harvard and Yale. I went to school with some exceptionally bright people, and I was sixth in my class. Very high expectations of me when I went to college. I went to college on a full scholarship at University of South Carolina in the honors program there. And I just could not live up to those high standards and my parents' high standards. And I became suicidal. Had to leave school after my second semester, or in the middle of my second semester there, I had to leave. Towards the start of the school year, I joined a role-playing games group there. I went to 3 sessions, played a cool game. They were great people. They could have been really good friends. And I was talking with my parents about it. My parents basically insisted that I quit the group and focus on my studies. And I have long thought that had I stayed in that role-playing game group, I would not have failed out of college. I would not have ever contemplated suicide. I'd never have been depressed because I would have had friends. I would have had a support group. And I really think it would have been better. I almost wish that Dallas Egbert had played D&D in college. Because it seems to me, and I'm speaking from personal experience here, the lack of social interaction is one of the key things that really contributes to depression in those circumstances.
It certainly can, and it bears mentioning at this point that both Grant and I are introverts.
Yeah. The funny thing about D&D is that it's an introverted game that makes you social. Introverts, the classic definition I've heard is that extroverts have a lot of lightweight connections to people. Introverts have close friendships with a small group of people.
And part of the reason for that is, that extroverts tend to get energized by a lot of intense, constant social interaction with a large group of people. We introverts find that exhausting.
That's the Dallas Egbert case, sort of in summary. There is another case from 2001, Clara Schwartz.
And this one is creepy, honestly.
It is creepy. And what's interesting is there is an episode of a show called Snapped, which currently runs on the Oprah Winfrey Network. My wife happened to catch it. She watches bad daytime television while cross-stitching or something like that. She saw it and mentioned it to me because she knew I'd be interested in it. Clara Schwartz it's the only case I've been able to find where there was any real connection to role-playing games, and even that's fairly tangential. It's a case of a woman, or young girl, late teenager-y. Yeah.
Early college, late high school.
Yeah, kind of that range, who ended up convincing a unmedicated schizophrenic to kill her father for her. And kind of used his interest in fantasy to convince him that she was a damsel in distress who needed to be saved from her father. Genuinely creepy, genuinely manipulative, certainly not going to defend her.
No.
In any sort of way.
This had some whiffs of Charles Manson in it, in fact.
Yeah, kind of the same brainwashing pretty, sort of thing.
Pretty horrible stuff.
She met him at a Renaissance festival and kind of became friends with him that way and sort of used him in that regard. She's been sentenced to, I think, 48 years in prison, and he's in prison for life.
I would say probably the one good thing out of this story is that they didn't get away with it, but it was genuinely tragic and...
Yeah, but the role-playing game thing enters into it because it was brought up in a trial that Clara Schwartz had run a role-playing game previously where she used her father as the big bad villain, and the point of the game was to kill her father at the end of it, or at least the character that sort of represented her father. It's not a case of using RPGs to brainwash people or anything like that, but it's sort of an indication of how somebody's hobbies can reflect their own twisted natures if they really get out of whack. I actually was able to see a preview of this episode. It's coming out again Sunday, and I'm going to try and catch it then. But it's interesting. 30 years after the Dallas Egbert case and the media coverage of it, there's this episode of Snapped from 2012 starts off like this. Clara Schwartz was a shy, quiet girl who loved escapist fantasy. Immediately cuts to a professional-looking man saying, vampires, goths, role-playing, that sort of thing. It's funny how little has changed in 30 years, and that's one of the things that I would really love to help change with this podcast.
Yeah, same here.
So, let's not kid ourselves. There's a lot of scaremongering involved, but there is occasionally somebody who can't tell reality from fiction that's not related to role-playing games or whatever hobby or fantasy they end up dreaming up.
And let's be clear about this. Those people deserve compassion and help.
Yeah.
Not scorn, not derision, not condemnation that they are somehow damned or something. Those people need compassionate professional help.
Yes. I mean, in a case like this where, she's essentially conspired to commit murder, certainly there's punishment there as well, but...
Yeah. I'm talking more about the person she was manipulating.
Yeah.
In her case, the justice system has appropriate measures for people who try and hire people to murder people for them, regardless of whether they do it the way she did through manipulation or the old-fashioned, time-honored mafia way of giving somebody a suitcase full of money and a gun.
Yeah. And that's something that we're going to talk about probably in a little bit, is the idea of escapism and addiction. So I think we've kind of covered at this point everything we could think of that was common misconceptions that we know about, and things that people worry about with role-playing games.
And by the way, listeners, if you've got anything that you think we should add to this list, get in contact with us through one of our social network channels or...
Yeah, comment on this post on our blog. Yeah, leave a comment for us. We'd love to hear about it.
Yeah, we may even address it in a later episode if it's good enough. So.
Yes, please. So if you know anything, please let us know. Now, we've talked a lot about things that aren't true. Let's shift gears here and talk about things that are true about role-playing games and how Christians can play them and why they should play them.
Okay, so the first thing that we kind of agreed on is the proverbial power of myth, which is that sometimes you can make a point better using fictionalized versions of whatever story that you're trying to tell than you could kind of fumbling around in the dark trying to find a real-world example. We alluded to the hero's journey a little bit earlier, which is kind of a common theme in, it's particularly Western mythology, but I think you'll find it in other parts of the world too, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of general principles of virtue and courage and that sort of thing. It's easier to kind of practice with these things at a gaming table when there's nothing really truly at stake yet. And you can kind of start building up some of those reflexes a little bit as you go on, where, maybe the next time you have something where you've got the right thing to do and the easy thing to do, that you've maybe built up the do the right thing reflex and it's not quite as difficult for you, or you're more willing to accept the consequences.
Myth can be used to reawaken a sensitivity to the times when you should hold true to certain values that have sort of become swamped by familiarity. In fact, there's a C.S. Lewis quote that I've always really liked in regards to this. This is actually from his review of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings series. The value of myth is that it takes all the things you know and restores to them the rich significance which has been hidden by the veil of familiarity.
That is a good quote.
It is. What Lewis is saying there is, it's the same way that Christ used parables to reteach us the moral lessons that we know, or that we should know. By presenting them in a different light, we get to look at them anew and put them in different contexts and say, ah, this is like this. It's a universal truth. It's not just the rut that I'm in here. It's bigger than that, and it's better than that.
Well, and specifically the parable that kind of pops out in my mind, if we're going to draw a comparison between role-playing and Christ's parables, is the parable of the Good Samaritan.
Yes.
You've got somebody who's in a terrible fix. He's just been robbed, beaten, stripped, and left on the side of the road to bleed out by the robbers, basically. And you have a couple of people that, by all rights, should have stopped to help him, but for whatever reason seemed good to them in their mind at the time. They didn't want to become ritually unclean. They thought it might have been a trap. There's 1,000 good reasons to not stop and help that person. The person that stopped was a Samaritan, a kind of a traditional enemy of the guy lying there on the side of the road, and I'm sure the rest of the Christians in our audience know the rest of the story. He binds his wounds, he disinfects them as best he can with what he's got on hand, he gets the guy to an inn, he actually pays the innkeeper to take care of him for a while he's off on business,
Yes. And
leaves with the promise that he will pay up anything else that the innkeeper needs to spend taking care of this guy while he's gone. That's not altogether dissimilar from the way that heroic PCs will act in a role-playing game. You know, you'll be sitting there with your group of friends, and you've kind of cracked open the sodas and the chips, and you're sitting there, and you're kind of done with the let's catch up after our busy week part of the thing, and it gets down to the session, and the person running the game, the GM or DM or whatever you call them in the system that you're playing, throws something out there, and there's a person, one of the more common things I've seen is there's some kind of innocent person out there who, through no fault of their own, is in some sort of peril. What do you do? Generally speaking, player characters will rise to that occasion.
Yep.
Portraying somebody who does the right thing reflexively without really having to think is going to have a beneficial effect on your conscience over time.
In a way, it's exercising those moral muscles, practicing to be a better person. And that, I think, is one of the most valuable things about role-playing games. It lets you practice being a good person in contexts you don't normally encounter in everyday life.
Yeah, no matter how dangerous a neighborhood you live in, you're not going to have to deal with, you know, a squad of rampaging orcs coming barreling out of an alley.
It's unlikely, yes. But the human relationships stay the same. And that's invaluable, especially for introverts who don't interact with a lot of people on a regular basis. People like me, I work an office job. Most of my interaction with people is over the phone, helping people with technical issues. I see the same people at my small office day in and day out. I have a small group of friends. It's my wife, and in 8 weeks it'll be a child. That's almost entirely my social circle aside from people I know online.
And mine's even smaller. I don't even work in an office. I work in a shipping and receiving department. A lot of the time I'm back there alone, just dealing with freight or paperwork or something technical that needs to be fixed around the place.
Yep.
And I will interact with maybe a half dozen coworkers throughout the day, and then I come, because I'm an introvert, I don't go out to a bar with friends or something afterwards. I get in the car and I go home.
Yep.
And at home is my wife and a cat.
So it's easy to get into a rut.
Yeah.
For people like us. And role-playing games help break us out of that rut, both through being social with groups of people and with thinking of things in a different way and reapplying the things we know to be good in different situations.
One other thing that I should add for the Christians in the audience, church has a very similar and even more beneficial role in your life if you're an introvert like us.
Yes, that's something we'll probably talk about at some point. Peter's recommended to me, and I am hoping to start reading it soon, an excellent book, Introverts in the Church, which, again, we may link in the show notes here.
Yeah, if you are a Christian and an introvert, and if you are listening to this podcast, there's a good chance you are, I could not recommend that book more highly. It is full of both a lot of validating and healing insights, and a lot of really good practical advice.
Yes, and for that matter, if you're somebody in a church who's wondering how to connect with an introvert you think may be having trouble, or somebody who wants to get into the church.
Or if you're wondering why you have certain members of your congregation that kind of spiral in and out.
Go pick that
up. Pick the book up.
It may help you. So, socialization is another thing that we've kind of brought up here, too. Just talking with people. Like I said earlier, I wish I had been in a role-playing game group in college, because I needed to be social and have a support group when I was failing in college, and I didn't have that. I really think it would have helped me to have people who I could talk to, who were fun and interesting and shared a hobby and an interest.
Who might have also been a good influence in other ways academically and that sort of thing?
Exactly. I mean, you know, there were freshmen like me in there, there were seniors in there, a whole range of people in that group who I really wish I could have become friends with looking back on it. Now, I've had a pretty good life. I'm not going to say that not being in that group was not part of God's plan. I would not have gone to Furman and met my wife if I hadn't failed out of the University of South Carolina.
Yeah, it is kind of hard to look back as married men on anything that kind of ultimately led to the point where we met our spouses.
Yeah.
In any kind of a negative light. It's like, oh, I wish I had done, you know, this, this, and the other thing differently. But then again, I probably wouldn't have met Nikki and, oh, that would, yeah, that would be bad.
That would be bad, yes. You know, I wouldn't have a daughter on the way, and I wouldn't be giddy about it. I'm pretty sure God knew what was best for me there.
Oh, and you guys can't hear it on the podcast, but he has been quite giddy about it.
Yeah, I really have. In fact, I'm pretty sure Peter wants to throw something through the internet at me. I do not stop talking about that child.
You're not to the point of annoying giddiness yet.
Fair enough.
I imagine you'll get there eventually, but you need to try a little harder.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, sorry. Wait till the, wait till the pictures start, all right? It's coming.
Oh, jeez.
It's coming.
I've been there with another friend of mine already. I'm braced for this. This is fine.
Oh, yeah. Anyway.
If you stack them up, you can actually make a flip book and watch the baby crawl.
That's true. That's very true. No, we don't need to do that. That's what video cameras are for. Cell phones. But socialization, I think, is an important thing, and especially for introverts and people who don't have a lot of people to talk to, that's invaluable.
And as a very obvious, concrete example of this, Grant and I would have no idea that the other one even existed if not for role-playing games.
We wouldn't be talking to you right now. Whether that's a good thing or not, I'll let you decide later.
Yeah.
But.
Please give us a few more episodes before you make that final decision, too.
Yeah. Yes, please. So, socialization, and not just socialization in the sense of getting out and talking to people. Christians should play role-playing games because if there's somebody who has questions about Christianity, it would be a real shame if there weren't any Christians at the role-playing game table to answer them, if there were people who didn't have the right answers. It's incumbent upon us to be able to answer those questions.
Yeah, we should not exclude ourselves from what are essentially mediums, like we've mentioned before, print, film, games. These are all just the medium on which you put the rest of your material. So if we take ourselves out of the gaming sphere, that's an entire way of communicating content that we've cut ourselves off from. This is not the distinction between a legitimate movie and a work of pornography or a snuff film. This is the difference between a printed book and a musical score.
Yeah. Honestly, if saints and martyrs can go into some of the worst places on earth and preach the word of God through good deeds and good actions and knowing the gospel, the least we can do is go have fun with friends and do the same.
Yeah. If people can go out into the most horrible war-torn parts of Africa to spread the gospel, the least we can do is go into a friend's basement every once in a while. I mean, come on.
Yeah. And that's sort of the next point I want to bring up is evangelism. I don't recommend soapbox, megaphone, street corner evangelism at your role-playing table.
What I like to refer to as sledgehammer Christianity, whereby you attempt to pound somebody into the kingdom.
Right.
Usually just verbally, thank goodness, but...
We're well past the Middle Ages at this point.
Yes, thank goodness.
Yes.
I rather like indoor plumbing.
That's the same here. But it's... There's a St. Francis quote that you brought to my attention that I think is...
Yeah, preach the gospel at all times and when necessary use words. And I think that's good in that we should be living a upright and blameless life. But I think also that teaches us to maybe stop jabbering at people, which I know is ironic coming from people who are doing a podcast.
Yeah.
But
No, no, if we claim that we're introverts enough, it'll be okay.
Yeah, that's true. Find out what somebody's problems are before you try and solve them with a one-size-fits-all solution. Generally speaking, people these days who aren't Christians already are savvy. They are suspicious of being aggressively proselytized to because a lot of them have had at least one negative experience. And before you're going to get anywhere with trying to convert people, you have to form a relationship with them. And a lot of the time, the points where you're going to have the best opportunity to make any sort of what we would consider headway in evangelism are when those people are going through something hard. And instead of giving them trite, oh, just join a church or just accept Christ as your personal savior and everything will be okay, come alongside them, show them real compassion. And once they have gotten through the harder spell that they are in, the source of that compassion may be something that they're curious about. I think way too often we Christians will reduce evangelism to a sales pitch. And the idea is to get the information in, close the sale, and get out of there as quickly as possible. And you will get people who will, sometimes even battered and hounded enough, make an insincere, not meaningful conversion with somebody just to get them to go away. That is not a soul-changing experience. That does nothing for the person that's being evangelized.
And in fact may damage their future relationship with Christ because it's a sales pitch and it's annoyance as opposed to something genuine and caring.
Yeah.
And again, you won't hear us on this podcast attempt to overtly evangelize very much. I know I'm not very good at it.
I'm generally not either. I'm much better at the covert sort of evangelism.
Just keep that in mind. It's an opportunity to interact with people who aren't Christians. It's not an opportunity to sell them something. I think the salesman analogy Peter's got is absolutely accurate.
I would also challenge any Christian reader or listeners that we've got. Oh, readers, I'm used to writing a blog.
They might read the blog post. It's okay.
Yeah, that's
cool.
True. Any Christian consumers of our content
that
we have, that if your church is not friendly to gamers, find one that is and at least get occasionally involved. Because if one of them starts, that's not a Christian, starts expressing interest of going to church with you, you want to take them someplace where they will actually be welcome. And if the church that you are attending is angry, judgmental, legalistic, and otherwise pharisaical, that is not a safe, welcoming place to bring any kind of new believer, much less one that is coming to it from geek culture.
Yes, and while I hesitate to suggest anybody ever leave a church, if you're finding it pharisaical and judgmental, that may not be where Christ wants you to be either.
Well, and there's also the argument to be made that if you have to, you may want to attend more than one church for a while.
Yes.
If you think you can do some good at the one that's somewhat pharisaical and help to tear down some of those barriers, by all means do it. I wish you the best, and if you tell me about it, I'll pray for you. I wouldn't want that challenge.
No. But if you can do it...
Yeah, if you can do it, yeah.
And speaking of countering evil, we kind of talked about this towards the start of this episode, and I realize that's a ways back now.
Yeah. It's kind of an irresistible place to go with this because it's so obvious.
I know. Countering evil. Most RPGs, and interestingly, most commonly, fantasy role-playing games, involve explicitly opposing overt evil in the world. The enemies of man and the enemies of God. Demons, creatures that would enslave people, creatures that prey on humanity in some form or another, amoral monsters, evil men trying to corrupt society, churches.
Or just destroy.
People just willing to just destroy things for their own power and glory. And it's the role of the player characters in almost every instance to oppose these things and shut them down.
And one of the things that's very cool about doing this in role-playing games is a lot of the time, you can succeed and succeed spectacularly.
Yes.
And that's very gratifying.
It is. And perhaps most importantly, it encourages people to try and do so elsewhere. While you're unlikely again to find giant dragons terrorizing a population, the more human evils, they exist in abundance.
Yeah, it may give you the courage that you need to help somebody who's been mugged stand up to a bully in your workplace or your school.
Yes, and perhaps most importantly, it may help if you are running a game like this, you may help teach others to do this, especially
yes.
children. A friend of ours who runs a role-playing game group at her church for children with exactly this sort of intent, to teach children that it's okay to do something other than stand by and watch things happen.
Yeah.
And aside from this sort of practice, there's also an exploratory role. I have personally used games for this, where I want to explore an aspect of my own personality. In fact, explore parts of my own faith that I don't really feel comfortable with doing in any other context, but it's an opportunity for me to play around with concepts and to take little pieces of myself and examine them in a microscope and say, what part of me is this, and how can I improve this? How can I excise the bad and keep the good?
Well, or here's a tricky moral situation. How do I feel about this?
A situation where there doesn't seem to be a right answer or two good answers. What's the proper way to do it? The game I'm wrapping up here in a little bit over the next few weeks, I'm actually playing a Catholic priest, precisely because I wanted to explore and encourage the part of me that's, you know, very Christian and really craves the ritual and deep Christian faith kind of inherent in the Catholic Church. The idea of a priest as a protector of the flock. There are games that do it at a much more psychological level. Don't Rest Your Head, which is sort of about exploring somebody's personality in a weird, twisted, neverwhere-ish sort of way, but it absolutely works. The great thing about role-playing games is that it gives you the opportunity to deal with hard questions. And in many cases, there's social pressure to deal with that hard question rather than shy away from it, from the rest of the group. There's real value in that, especially for people trying to create a Christian fellowship and teach people about Christ. It's a good opportunity to say, well, here's how a Christian might handle that. Now, we've talked about fake problems, and we've talked about real reasons to play RPGs.
Let's talk about some real problems,
yes.
Because this can come in with any kind of hobby or media, and gaming is not excluded, and we need to be fair about this. So the first one that we've got that is on our list is escapism. Now, I'm very firmly of the belief that escapism is a little bit like alcohol. A small amount of it is fine, possibly even beneficial. I've heard plenty of, you know, nutritionists saying that red wine in moderation can be good for you. It contains mm-hmm. antioxidants, that sort of thing. However, if you drink three bottles of it, you're not doing yourself any favors. And I think the same can be said about escapism. You can indulge in any number of things for escapism. Reading, television is probably the most popular form in our culture. Some people will throw on some headphones and just zone out to some music.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain extent, that can be healthy. It's good to sometimes turn off the things that stress you out, do something enjoyable for a while, recharge your mental, emotional, and social batteries, and come back at life in an enriched and rested state. Pretty much anybody who knows anything about stress will tell you that. It's one of the reasons why it's so good to maintain a healthy work-life balance as an employee someplace, because your performance will suffer if you don't ever kind of escape from your work. However, if you've gotten to the point where you're retreating from everything, and you're doing it to excess, and the lines between fantasy and reality are getting a little bit blurry, you've gone from the person who's having one glass of red wine with their dinner to the person who's downing three bottles of Jack Daniels in a binge weekend. It's not healthy, and you need to step back.
Yeah, absolutely.
Role-playing games can be insidious this way because they are such a rich and enjoyable experience. Video games can be just as bad. In particular, massively multiplayer games like World of Warcraft can latch their hooks into people and hold them in place for far longer than they should.
Mm-hmm. They're explicitly designed to do so in many cases. They use a lot of psychological tricks and techniques to keep people playing because the subscription is how they make their money.
Yep, or the microtransactions or whatever else have you is
sure.
in there. That said, I have probably played more than is healthy of games that were not designed to separate me from my disposable income beyond the initial purchase. This is one of those things where we really shouldn't go around judging each other, but we should take a very unflinching look at our own habits and try to keep things at a healthy level, maybe discuss it. If you have some concerns, they're probably legitimate, but discuss with your spouse or a close friend. They'll probably tell you if you've gone too too far off the deep end with any form of escapism, whether it's role-playing or not.
And it's worth noting that escapism is not just escaping to something. It's escaping from something.
Absolutely.
If you know somebody, or if you are finding yourself going into this escape, these escapist fantasies, what problem are they are they just not dealing with? Again, I'll use a personal example. My college career, I was terribly lonely. I was failing most of my classes. I was terribly depressed. I escaped to the internet. I would spend all day. I'd skip class, just browsing the internet, not looking at anything, keeping up with blogs that didn't interest me terribly, reading webcomics, just trying to sort of engage my brain, but not in any real way, and not deal with the things that were giving me trouble. It's easy to do in a world where we always have media at our fingertips. It's maybe easier to do now than it has ever been. Escapism doesn't happen because we're bored. It happens because there's something unpleasant that we just don't want to deal with and don't have the fortitude to face up to. So if you know somebody like that...
And once again, we're talking about unhealthy escapism here. If all you're trying to escape from is the fact that you're tired after a day of heavy physical labor, by all means, park yourself at the gaming table and have yourself some fun.
Yeah, recharge.
Yeah.
If it's excessive, that is a problem. It's not a problem with any particular hobby, it's a problem with all hobbies and all forms of entertainment. And it can be a serious problem because, in my case, certainly I was terribly depressed and wasn't doing anything about it because I wasn't dealing with the core problem. The other thing that's somewhat related is addiction. We normally think of addiction as a chemical thing. Alcohol.
This is
drugs.
Another place where the alcohol analogy fits well.
It's always possible to sort of get addicted to the high you get doing something like this, including a role-playing game. And there's a real social and emotional high when you're in a good role-playing game because you're having fun. Endorphins are flowing. You're excited by things that are going well.
You and your friends are laughing and throwing dice around and eating food together. It's a heady, fun, enjoyable experience.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people who are far less nerdy than Grant and myself will get the same kind of a rush off of watching a sporting event with friends.
Absolutely. It is, however, possible to, I'm not going to say get addicted to socializing and having fun necessarily, but addictions are damaging because other things fall by the wayside.
Well, and there's one other thing that role-playing has that the other hobbies that we've been touching on don't, and that's a heavy cerebral aspect in a lot of games. Nerds like to sit down and crunch and fiddle and play around with concepts and that sort of thing. Yeah. I mean, there's that guy in every gaming group who's a math major or an engineer or somebody else who, through some unfathomable quirk of the human psyche, actually will sit down and do long math problems as recreation. A lot of the rest of us have to have some kind of context attached to it, but it still plugs into that same part of our brain. And that can become unhealthy, especially if that becomes coupled to an impulse towards completionism and you are buying, like, everything that's ever had the logo of your favorite role-playing game.
And this,
on
I think, is the real danger.
Now, admittedly, this is more dangerous with, this is more dangerous with certain systems than others. I mean, if you get massively, horribly addicted to Dogs in the Vineyard, you've got, what, maybe two books? You've got one copy to play with and one copy that's been signed by the author, and you're done. If, however, you manage to get yourself hooked on GURPS, heaven help you, because no other force can. There are so many GURPS books out there that I think you would probably need a six-figure income for a couple of years to track them all down and get copies that are in pristine condition.
It kind of comes down to stewardship. Managing your money, managing your time. If your interest in the hobby doesn't let you do that, maybe it's time to stop or cut back. Talk to people about it.
Even just if you've got somebody who you can have hold you accountable in your group, that can be enough. Bob, why do you have another book? I know you just got paid and you've got rent to pay.
Yeah.
Stop it, you know?
I know I have seen this in my group less with money and more with time. There was a time when my wife and her best friend just sort of felt like gaming widows. The guys of the group were doing a fair bit of gaming, and they certainly felt like they were getting neglected. And looking back on it, I really should have probably spent more time with my wife. It's that sort of thing.
the same as a football widow. Any hobby can turn into something that isolates you from your loved ones if you let it.
There is, kind of along the same veins, obsession. Just thinking about the game that you're in, or products, or the ideas in there. Just thinking about it over and over. Some of this is sort of the Clara Schwartz thing we were talking about, where it just sort of gets into your head, and you can't separate fact from fiction. But some of it is also just being distracted. This has happened to me a little bit back when I was playing a lot of D&D. I'd think about D&D at work. I wouldn't be thinking about work. And I'd be doing character math in my head and be like, ooh, that'd be a really cool idea. And by cool idea, I meant the numbers were bigger.
Yeah. I've got an example of this myself with a different hobby that will also feed in. A few years ago, I got into white boxing, or building my own, for those that aren't familiar with the term, computers. I had a nasty malware infection on the computer I was using at the time, which was a hand-me-down, and I kind of hit an enough-is-enough thing, and I'm just going to build my own. That has since become another hobby of mine, and there have been times where I've been at work, and I should be working, and I have grabbed a piece of scratch paper and started, like, writing down components I wanted to research, or some, you know, new configuration of the system that I wanted to do at home or something. Yes, I know, I'm a terrible nerd. You wouldn't be listening to this podcast if you weren't too. Don't kid yourself. but any kind of hobby can do this to you. I've seen it happen with fantasy football. I've heard stories of people who work newsstands or in the magazine departments of bookstores who have gotten treated incredibly rudely by somebody who wants the latest and greatest fantasy football magazine because they need the stats and they need it right now. And no, I can't wait until the end of the day. If you reach that point with any hobby, role-playing included,
yes,
you've got a problem. and you need to find a solution to it. Whether you just consciously step back or you go get some help from your loved ones, this has gone too far.
Yes. And if you know somebody in that state, step in. Help them out. You'll both be better for it.
And honestly, one of the probably the best ways of doing that, at least at first, a good first thing to try, is give them something else to care about besides the thing that they're obsessing over. A lot of the time, people get obsessive about stuff because it kind of feeds off of escapism. There's something in their life that's kind of lousy. And they might even know about it and be dealing with it a little bit, but it's just so easy to think about this more pleasant thing instead. So give them more than one pleasant thing to think about and split that energy up a little bit.
Yeah. Take them to church, go bowling with them, go see a movie.
Take them out to dinner, grab some coffee, hang out for a while, you know?
As much as anything, break your friend out of that rut that they're in, that mental rut. That helps a lot. Just doing different things.
My wife has been very helpful to me in that regard sometimes. It's like, hey, you're doing nothing but sitting in front of the computer. Let's go play mini golf this weekend, or, you know, let's go do this or that.
Perhaps the one thing I miss most that my wife can't do now that she's pregnant.
Mini golf.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine mini golf is kind of hard with another human attached to your midsection.
It's a little difficult. Yeah.
Yeah.
Funny thing, though. The last thing that I think is a potential problem is the only one on here that I think is a gaming-specific thing. That's what I would call the static evil campaign.
This is kind of a non-standard campaign, but it's popular enough where we've kind of felt the need to address this.
Right. It is, I think, very possible, and I think a very good and valuable thing, to play a character who starts off evil and is redeemed.
Or even just flawed.
Yeah, let's even set aside evil in this case. Somebody who's got some deep flaws and is, through some means, redeemed. Redemption is, after all, why we call ourselves Christians.
That is the central point of Christianity, is Christ being sent to redeem all of us wretched sinners.
Exactly. It is possible, however, to play a campaign where you start off flawed or evil and stay that way. There's a thing, especially in D&D, that I've heard where it's, let's do something different. Let's do an evil campaign where we're all evil characters. We're all some horrible monster, and everybody's alignment is some form of evil.
Putting aside just how corny this is for a moment.
And it's corny.
Oh, yeah. This is not a healthy thing to do. The idea of just indulging your dark side and crawling into whatever depths of depravity you have floating around in yourself, even in a fictionalized context, not a really edifying thing to be doing.
No, there's not a lot of value in that. Now, to a certain degree, it's kind of self-solving. Evil tends to be boring. It's static. It's banal. There's no value in it. There's nothing that comes out of it.
And let's be honest, nobody likes evil people.
Yeah, I've seen people try and do this, and they just got bored and never did it again. And perhaps that was a good thing. I don't know. But there's no redeeming quality to it. And I would recommend avoiding that.
If you are somehow in one of these games and you have noticed that what we have discussed here has happened,
turn it into a redemption story.
I was going to say that. It's, instead of just letting the thing die on the vine, like so many games are wont to do,
yep.
Talk to your group and talk to your, you know, your GM and say, what would it take to turn this into a redemption story? You want to, at the end of the campaign, to have the characters basically be wearing the white hats instead of the black one.
And in fact, I'm in a game like this right now. Necessary Evil is a superhero game based around that redemption story.
I was hoping you were going to go there.
It's a fun game. For those not familiar with it, it's a comic book superhero setting where all of the superheroes have been killed in an alien invasion, which leaves only supervillains to defend Earth. And the supervillain's response was basically, no, I was going to conquer Earth, and now you've done it, and that's not right. I was here first. It's mine. Get off. So you get supervillains teaming up to fight off these alien invaders. The plot in the campaign is basically that these supervillains, who are more or less terrible, in our group they were actually really terrible people, basically learn to be superheroes and learn to protect others and just be better people. There's a lot of value in that, especially in reflecting our redemption through Christ. Turning from people who are selfish and in many ways genuinely evil to becoming someone who thinks about something other than themselves, who doesn't just use people. It's an interesting story, it's very valid, and I think very valuable as a teaching tool for Christians.
Yeah, this kind of has some particular appeal to me as a Methodist, because one of the things that makes Methodism unique is the idea of ongoing sanctification. We're supposed to get better the longer we believe. So this is kind of a neat way of modeling that in a fictionalized context, is you start out with somebody who is in a very dark place morally and who has some sort of a life-changing experience and then walks towards the light until the darkness is so far behind them they can't see it anymore.
Yep.
We're running a little long here, but I think we should probably take a few minutes and detail some of our own positive experiences with gaming, just so they've got something concrete on that side to go with, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have one character in mind that would probably work well, but why don't you go first, because I have a feeling that this Necessary Evil character might be the one that you want to talk about. Or
in some ways, actually, the Necessary Evil character is interesting in several ways. He's actually a mentally retarded supervillain.
Okay.
Who's very childish, acts out. I don't mean mentally retarded in a hoo-hoo, that's retarded kind of way. I mean, it's as close as I can get to modeling something like Asperger's and developmental disabilities.
Okay, so more like socially handicapped than truly mentally, huh?
No, mentally handicapped too. He's got a lot of issues.
Okay.
Which makes him interesting to play. And it's an interesting thing to explore because it's something I don't know anything about. And I've learned a lot from it. And he, in many ways, has sort of started leading the party towards this moral redemption. He's got a certain childish innocence still. He can change because he has less conception of, a less solid picture of himself. And that's been an interesting character to explore. I've got another character who, like I said, is a Catholic priest, which I actually specifically created for the same reason, really, that I'm doing this podcast for myself. To kick myself in the butt and say, hey, start thinking about God and start learning about God again. And that's been very valuable for me because that's helped get me thinking as a Christian again, as opposed to a husband, an IT guy, all the other labels. So those have been good, and I know also, even aside from explicitly Christian things, I have helped a lot of people through a lot of fairly difficult things just by virtue of being there for them in the context of a role-playing game. I know there are some guys we know, like Mobius on the Fear of the Boot forums, very good at this sort of thing. being available to talk to and being a friend in a time of need.
Yeah.
And being an example of somebody who's a Christian and a gamer, especially in my group, because most of my group is not Christian.
Most of mine have been either. I actually had one in one of my previous groups, and I almost didn't know what to do with myself. I was so elated. It's like, yay, somebody coming from the same background as me, finally. My example of this was, I had a character a while ago that, kind of as part of his backstory, had been a very, very bad person, kind of like the Black Knight archetype, who had basically had his memory erased and been given a second chance to start over, and slowly uncovered bits and pieces about the person that he used to be, and was horrified, and set it as his goal to not be that person anymore, to, in a number of ways, actually be that person's direct opposite. That was a really fascinating, interesting character to play, because he had done so many terrible things in his past that any kind of, like, human sense of balancing the scale where I'm just going to do enough good deeds to outweigh all of this evil stuff just wasn't going to happen. I mean, that people that have been killed are dead. Something that's been destroyed can be rebuilt, but it won't ever be the same thing again. He did a lot of awful, terrible, permanent things, and he was kind of left with three choices, really. Do I want to fall back into that and just become this terrible engine of suffering and misery again? Do I want to succumb to despair, refuse to offer any forgiveness to myself, not seek it from anyone else, and just either end myself or just go off into the wilderness with my sorrow? Or do I want to do the most difficult thing, and while I will never balance the scale, try and take everything that I do from this point forward and make it into something good? And he struggled with that a little bit, and I ultimately had him choose the last path, and it was very rewarding. It wasn't particularly easy. If anybody is familiar with either the Dragonlance or the Ravenloft settings, this character was Lord Soth.
Oof.
And I found out that that's who he was in play. The GM kind of had us create a basic archetype for who our character was and then go from there. So this was essentially the Darth Vader of two separate fantasy universes. And that was interesting.
I'm still in that character concept, by the way.
Oh, feel free. Go for it. I would love to play another character like that again. Because I didn't even realize what I was playing for a while. And once I realized, it was like, ooh, I can run with this.
Any others?
Well, kind of like you, I've had some stuff that's happened around the table, but wasn't specifically part of the game. I made one of my very closest friends in the entire world, who I have been through, boy, thick and thin with. He and I have, and to a lesser extent, our spouses have been through some really horrific times in our respective lives and kind of helped each other get through and been there to discuss crises that we've had in our lives, you know, both internal and external, and sometimes even help each other in tangential ways, and I wouldn't have that relationship if not for gaming. I know a lot of people that I would consider friends now through the forums of Fear the Boot, which is a role-playing podcast, you included. So I think this, like any other hobby, can be very enriching, and I think the possibility for this to be enriching is actually greater than something like stamp collecting or model railroading that is typically a very solitary activity.
Yeah, or even social activities like weekly poker night or something like that. I think role-playing games have some more inherent value than something like that.
Yeah, they're a little bit a higher class of entertainment, I think, when it comes to the possibility for creating actual relationships, at least, than a lot of other things that you could do to spend your time.
Yeah, and creative is maybe the word there. Role-playing games are good at creating not just stories, but also social bonds between each other.
Well, it's one of the very few hobbies that you can have that's both creative and collaborative at the same time. Improv acting, maybe, is the only other one I can think of.
Yeah, which in a weird way is
very closely related to role-playing, It's improv acting is basically role-playing without the dice.
Yes, it's no rules role-playing.
Yeah. And I think with that, we're probably going to wrap this one up, folks. Did you have anything else that you wanted to throw out there before we finish, Grant?
No, except that if you aren't already, come to our website, savingthegamepodcast.org. We've got links there to the show notes, all of our previous episodes, which this is episode one. There won't be any of those, except for our little introductory episode, but check out the others. And, of course, we've got links to our Facebook page, Twitter account, Google+, RSS feed. Go ahead and check those out. Subscribe if you're not already.
Comment on this episode if you found something interesting. We would love to hear from you.
And I think on that note, we can go ahead and wrap this up. Well, Peter, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. This has been good.
Yep, it's been a lot of fun, and we will talk to everybody else next time.
This has been a production of Saving the Game, copyright 2012. This podcast may be redistributed under a Creative Commons non-commercial, non-derivative license, provided that credit is given to savingthegamepodcast.org. Our music is by Ryan Humphrey. For past episodes, podcast news from our hosts, or to connect with us, visit our website at savingthegamepodcast.org. God bless, and happy gaming.